You're listening to the Hollywood Boulevard podcast.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to another exciting adventure on Hollywood Boulevard podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and it's 2021, everybody. This is the kickoff for the fifth season of the show, which I think there was one season where it was the same year, I think. So I think that's why it's on its fifth season. Normally it'd be on its probably its fourth season, because I think it started around the same time as Indie Film Cafe. So I'm going to introduce everybody here. I've got my co-host. Let's see, we've got Alfred Crane here. How you doing, Alfred?
Well, thank you. Great to be here for another year of Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, definitely. Alfred's been on the show since almost the beginning. We started with Donnie, and then we brought you on as our producer, and then as producer you became co-host. So
yeah,
and for that one season, the second season I think it was, you took over for a little bit. Yeah. You actually did your own solo episodes, so I thought that was cool. And then we've got Joe Turk. How you doing, Joe?
Doing great. Great to be back.
Yes,
and a little bit different role.
Yep, he is now going to be our co-host. So the way we're going to be doing it is, I'm going to be doing an episode. Alfred will do an episode, Joe will do an episode, then we'll come back to me to do another episode, and then so on and so forth. And then the last episode will be like our recap and talk about all the episodes that we did throughout the year for our 10th episode. So, and we have a special guest who hasn't been on this show before, but has been on multiple different shows. And in fact, I think this season of Indie Film Cafe, my plan is to get him on every single show as a guest, like once a month or something, you know, so that he has been on all the shows and can talk about whatever's going on and all that stuff. Please welcome Paul Presenza. How you doing, Paul?
How's it going, everybody? It's moveless to be on the show.
All right. So what is your nickname, Paul? I forgot to put it in there.
Oh, yeah. Otherwise known as the Moo Cow. Moo.
Yes. Because now otherwise it might be very confusing to our audience of why you started.
We don't want to cow fuse everyone.
No, not at all. So we're going to kick this off. I decided, okay, so there's a reason why I picked the movie that I picked, which is The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, not to be confused with anybody else's The Thing. But there's a reason, is because all four of us were in Film Freaks TV for the first episode that we did, and we did John Carpenter's The Fog. So I thought, why not bring it back to another John Carpenter movie. This one, I think, is a little bit more famous than The Fog, if I'm correct.
The Thing and The Fog.
Yeah, The Thing and The Fog. And I think Alfred did a episode where you talked about all the a bunch of the John Carpenter movies together, mm-hmm. like a mashup by yourself. And so if anyone wants to go back, those are on Blog Talk Radio, and you can find them on Apple Podcasts and stuff. You can listen to him talk about, I guess it was like The Thing, The Fog, Halloween, and They Live, I believe. So,
okay, so sort of on the golden era of John Carpenter, as opposed to the sort of, you know, bronzy or less version, yeah. towards
like,
the end, latter
like
part.
Vampires and, you know, all those
Ghost
other
of
ones.
Mars and yeah.
Ghost of Mars.
Or The Ward,
yeah.
which
The Ward,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, things like that.
Where, from LA was the worst, I think.
You know what? Honestly, I think because I had seen that before, Escape from New York, I actually kind of liked it. You know, when I watched it when I was a kid, I haven't seen it since it was on, like, I think Cinemax or something, or HBO, one of those channels. And I remember
Escape
watching
New York
it
is great. Escape from LA is terrible, though.
I know, but I remember, like, I don't know, enjoying that a little bit more than a lot of people did. A lot of people talk trash about that movie all the time, and I'm like,
sure.
It's not terrible.
When
I mean,
Snake
it's not...
Plissken starts surfing in the LA River, yeah, that's
yeah.
Come on,
bad.
That's kind of fun. I don't know.
That's like that shitty scene in the Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull with the monkeys and all that kind of shit.
There was a lot of people for Escape from LA when I saw it. I worked at the theater when it came out, and a lot of people came out and they were just so disgruntled with it. And you could, the first weekend, because it didn't do a whole lot of business, I don't believe. But
I was one
the
of
first
those
weekend,
it bombed, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot. There was a lot of people that weren't too fond.
Yeah, and you know, vampires. While it was disappointing, the movie itself wasn't that bad in my opinion. It's just I had read the John Stakeley novel, and I was thinking, oh wow, this should be really, really good. And it just wasn't nearly as good as the book.
Right. Well, I think honestly, a lot of people have told me that John Carpenter is kind of just pretty much just retired, you know, and I think that was when he sort of retired, you know, when he started, maybe even Escape from LA was his like first, like, I just don't give a fuck anymore kind of movie, because he started just like, he had so much money from all the movies that he's already done that he just became this, you know, guy that just sits at home all day, smokes pot and plays video games. He's like a big fucking kid, you know?
Sounds like heaven for a lot of people I know.
Right. I mean, like a lot of people love to just have
that
life.
Good on him. He's earned it. He's made a bunch of really great films and, you know.
Yeah. His, his library, so to speak, of films kind of showcase like he was wonderful. You know, he knew what he was doing. And The Thing is probably one of those ones that people have always claimed it as the high, you know, in high regard. Now, I picked this movie and I only seen it one other time other than this last time that I watched it. And it's not a movie I watch over and over again. I just know this is a movie everybody loves, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So when I picked it, it wasn't because I picked it because it's like one of my favorite movies. I picked it because I knew that this is a movie that a lot of people will want to talk about, especially you guys.
There's lots to talk about.
There is a lot to talk about. So to begin with, just to let everybody know, I Phil Alfred, and since we were talking about it earlier and I didn't mention it yet, I am, after watching it, I was not that into it as much as even the first time I watched it. It has moments that are just amazing. The effects are just incredible. Especially with the thing itself, you know, and you can see a lot of other people's inspiration for CGI stuff or whatever, like, you know, even like the Terminator, like in Terminator 2, where, you know, he gets sliced in half, like part of his body's falling off or whatever. I was like, oh man, I can kind of see where that, like, where James Cameron got the inspiration maybe from The Thing, you know, because some of the body parts are coming off and you can see the head, you know? And so I could see a lot of people being inspired by this film. It's just, to me, it suffers from the one thing I get bored by, which is the people in one location, you know, stuck in one location. And that's a me thing. We talked about that earlier. That's a me thing. I just don't like that. Some people don't mind it at all.
It's definitely a genius film. One of my favorites of John Carpenter's. And the very thing that you point out that you don't like is one of the things that I absolutely love about it, because, you know, in a regular film, I can see where that can be kind of annoying, but it ratchets up the tension so much more in the fact that you are in this very isolated location. You cannot escape. There is no other place to go. You are forced to this freaking thing, and it's so well named because this was a creature that was unlike anything else that had come before it in movie history. I mean, it really was a thing. It was almost indescribable and almost, you know, unheard of into what it could do, and nobody had any clue what this thing was going to do next. It was just amazing, and you were stuck there having to have to deal with it. And even towards the end, when you did deal with it, the fact was is that because of the extreme isolation, you're pretty much going to die anyway, and you almost have to in order to save everybody else. And that whole underlying tension, that whole extra bit of, you know, twist of the knife at the end kind of makes it even better, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely.
When you talk about something that you, not liking that, being in one place, one thing that I say about that is, with the cinematographer Dean Kundi, he did some great shots to mix it up to where you still felt claustrophobic in the sense of what the world was, but yet it didn't get boring, in my opinion, from the angles. So to me, it felt a lot bigger than it really was, like size wise, even though it was only in a small couple.
It got smaller as the movie went on too, because of the storm. So, you know, mm-hmm. you were able to go see like the other camp and some of the other places, and by the time the storm hits, you're down to just like one room at a time.
Right.
Whole opening sequence from Ennio Morricone's great soundtrack score to
fabulous.
Then going from the UFO falling to Earth and the classic thing opening, and then it goes black, and then it comes up with the pulses, and then you see the tundra, and then the dog. You're like, what's going on here? You know, it just drops you. It's almost like it literally, you come down with a UFO and you drop in the middle of this nowhere, and you're watching this tale unfold before you in the same somber tone.
Go ahead, Joe.
It's setting a somber tone.
Yeah, well, because it's like when I saw the dog and I saw them chasing, shooting the dog, I'm like, escape, get away, because you're always like rooting. I mean, because it doesn't seem like there's anything.
We're naturally rooting for the dog.
Yeah, and it's like in hindsight, it's like, oh, maybe we shouldn't have gone that direction with it.
Right.
But, I thought that was a brilliant opening.
Hey,
I
mean, Sweden, they're not Swedish, Jack. They're Norwegian.
even to the fact that they didn't even have the Universal logo at the beginning, because it kind of started right with the world with the ship coming in and stuff like that, or the spaceship coming in, but just in the music, like Alfred was saying, I can't believe that it got nominated for a Razzie. I was like, okay, I don't understand where that came from, but
really?
Yeah, I saw on when I was looking at, just doing a little bit of background on it,
that's crazy.
It was nominated for like a Razzie for score, and I'm like, and then I read that they used a little bit of some of the stuff that didn't get used in the score got used in one of Tarantino's later films,
Hateful
Eight. Yeah. So it's just, to me, I thought it was a brilliant.
Yeah, that's a classic score.
Yeah, and the score and the song on the closing credits where you just keep hearing that, doom, boom. I'm just like,
an epitome of modern minimalist. It's just absolutely fabulous. And in my opinion, it's another thing that helps ratchet up the tension.
Exactly. I want to go back to the dog bit, because I was, you know, I'd seen this movie before, so I knew that the dog was, you know, the second viewing, I knew that the dog was actually the thing, you know, and it was, you know, you kind of want them to kill it, I guess, in a way, now that you know, you know. But then I was like, but then there wouldn't be a movie if they just blew it up, you know, and somehow or whatever it all died. There would not be,
and
how, you know,
sneaky of Carpenter to hide the thing into the cute fuzzy dog that everybody loves, you know.
And there's some of the dogs
I can't watch in the movies when the dog turns, and that's one part I can't watch in the movie. Other than that, I'll watch the rest of the movie.
When the dog gets shot, man, that was brutal. You know, like
when all
that,
the dogs get shot, it's brutal. Yeah.
I know,
but
it's
amazing, because I don't know how many of you guys have seen the original thing with James Arness. You know, plot wise, it's somewhat similar, but there's a lot of scenes that are very, very, are completely, completely different. And while I like the original thing, this version just completely went like 10 levels up. It was just amazing. And part of that is just the way Carpenter introduced scenes, just like introducing the thing, but disguised as this cute, lovable dog that everyone's going to feel, you know, heartwarming and feel sorry for and want to protect. But it turns out that's the very thing that's going to kill you.
And that's we've talked about this in other podcasts. If they kill and do stuff to dogs, it just destroys me.
Right.
Films and stuff like that. And there's a handful of them in the pack that it's like when it goes crazy and stuff like that, it's just like, that's hard. That is hard to watch. Cause I mean, and it's the special effects and everything was so well done in the makeup. Yeah. And I mean, it's hard to watch, but yet watch it in the right context, it's fine. It's
the
just
worst
brilliant.
Part, in my opinion, was when the thing is inside the dog kennel, it's starting to change. And that one poor dog is trapped in the corner, and it's like got all the squiggly freaking things in there, and it tries to escape. And then the thing starts shooting that liquid out, and the poor dog is like, and he's like going back and forth. And cause he's like, I don't know what the hell that is. And I'm like, I don't know what the hell that is either. I don't want to go near it.
And I think he did something really great there too on that scene when he showed the dog trying to chew its way out of the fence.
Right.
It just shows the desperation that even the dogs will go through, just like humans. It was just brutal sequence. I mean, but it set it all up.
So perfectly. You're emotionally invested in what's going on with this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And one of my favorite scenes is when they're watching they go to the Norwegian camp and they see the video. And one of the classic scenes is when they're, even in the original, where they stay in the circle and they found the UFO and then they blow it up. And I think that was, for the sequel that is unnameable. They totally missed that in that. But anyways, we're talking about this one. But there's some classic scenes in it that still today when they go down into the UFO. And so I'm just like, and they didn't have to describe anything. They just show you this. And it's like, my brain goes off in all sorts of directions.
Wasn't the thing, like the other one, a prequel to the first one?
I didn't
see it, but...
I saw it way back in the day, and I haven't even thought about it since. Other than after watching this, I looked on the IMD, just read a little bit about it, and I was like, "Oh yeah, that's right. It's supposedly about the Norwegian camp and what happens to them."
But then they have Americans leading it, and I'm like, "Come on,
yeah."
Oh, that sucks. Because wasn't that like
as soon as that got released, I'm like, "Why would you ever do another movie? You can't come near this film."
I know. Well, I mean, because Hollywood needs money, and they know, like, you know, that's the thing. But here's the thing that bothers me about that is that, you know, the greatest thing about that is they couldn't understand what the guy was saying, you know, and there's no subtitles, so we have no idea what he was saying. And so we, as the audience, I mean, are just like these people, which, so I really dug that like thinking about it, we were stuck with these people just like they were stuck with these, you know, with everything that was going on. We knew just as much as they did. It wasn't like we were privy to any information that, you know, like, I hate those kind of tropes that people put because they, you know, you have to have explanation to why, blah, blah, blah. So they have somebody in another, like, maybe they would show the Norwegian camp, you know, and they would have like subtitles explaining what was going on. But
it's a great moment because when the Norwegians land and the guy's coming over with the gun and he's shooting at the dog and they're all trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And then the dog jumps onto, I forget the actor's name, the guy with the big beard, and she's like licking him furiously, kind of like, look, I'm a dog, love me, help me, protect me. And they're all thinking that this is just a regular dog, and this guy's going nuts, and he's trying to explain in Norwegian that nobody else can understand what's going on, and then he gets shot by Hopper.
Oh, so you're saying the Norwegian guy or the other guy with, like, because there's a couple of people with beards, I'm trying to remember what.
Yeah, no, I forget the name of the guy that he.
Not Wilford Brimley, but.
No.
It was like one of the geologists. I can't remember.
He was the guy on One Day at a Time.
Wasn't the Norwegian guy? Wasn't that played by Richard Mazur? If I'm correct.
Richard Mazur was the guy with the dog licking him.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was a dog handler, basically.
Right.
Yeah, he was the dog handler.
Okay. Good. I absolutely used to watch all his movies because he would be in like movies in the 90s. Like he would play.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The uncle,
he was a big guy for a while.
Yeah.
Head Office was a great one that he was in.
I saw that movie years ago.
License to Drive. License to Drive is the one I'm thinking of because he's the dad in that. It's just.
He was the uncle in My Girl. I mean, he was in like everything back in like the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, he was in One Day at a Time way back in the late 70s.
Yeah. So yeah, well there you go. So there you go.
With Schneider, yeah.
Speaking of the characters, you start bringing them all in at this point because after they have the shooting, they're fixing the one guy up, and then the hippie guy goes, "Well, El Capitan got to fire his pop gun."
And the guy who played Windows for years, I thought he was the same guy who was in the first Mad Max movie. I don't know if you guys know who I'm talking about, but. Johnny the Boy, he looks just like him, and they both look like Adam Ant. So between the three of them, I used to get them all confused.
Yeah, and then you have Donald Moffat. I mean, he played El Capitan basically. but he's like played presidents in a few other films. He's been in a ton of stuff through the years.
Was in the horrible Popeye movie.
Oh God!
Oh yeah, he was the tax man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, it's so funny because
I don't know if I should be talking so openly on that movie that I know that movie so well, huh?
Well, and you can't forget Keith David, who would go work with John Carpenter and They Live and a bunch of other movies.
I read that this was his first featured role, maybe.
Nice.
And also that he both him and Wilford Brimley were in this, and then they were both in that Scares the Care that one year, a couple years ago.
Nice. That's true.
That we saw. So.
Didn't Wilford Brimley like not cancel or something? Didn't he? Or was he back?
No, he was there.
He was there. Uh-huh. He was there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'd like to also point out that two of my favorite lines in movie history are in the thing.
I know one of them.
Yes.
Yeah, first is Moffat himself. He's like, I know you gentlemen have been through a rough time and things are pretty crazy, but I'd like to not spend the rest of the winter tied to this fucking chair is one of them. And then, of course, the other one being, you've got to be fucking kidding me.
Two great lines.
That was like the greatest moment, because to that point, it was just so horrible, but it was such a great light moment at that, because he's just said the exact thing everybody in the audience was thinking. And you see this little head walking out on antennas. It was just crazy.
One of my favorite lines is obviously, yeah, fuck you too. Like, I almost wish I had, because I thought about last night, I was like, I kind of want to open with that, but you know, like, it's kind of a strong opening right there going, yeah, fuck you too. You know, like, yeah,
the cast was great. And one thing, this whole cast, nobody was not believable. Everybody, you're totally invested in them. There's no like they were talking about, I was listening to the commentary and they're like, there's no comic relief. There's no Rob Schneider in this. The tension just escalates and escalates and escalates. And this guy says, you gotta be fucking kidding, but it still keeps building. It's not like something like, oh, ha, ha, ha. You know, these people just went through hell.
Exactly.
And like,
exactly.
You gotta be fucking kidding. It's like, what's next?
Right.
Well, I always remembered as when I watched it years ago, and the image that stuck with me was the head with the antennas and all that, when it pulled itself up and then just ran off, and leading to that sequence, it was just like, okay. That just always stuck with me. So I was like, when I was watching it last night, I was like, okay, when's it? I was trying to remember the exact spot and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, here we go. And my wife was in the room and I was like, you might want to turn away here. I was like, there's a few spots in this one. Cause it's pretty graphic.
It's graphic as fuck.
And you know what? I'll bet you $10 Paige has not seen this film. I'm dying to show it to her.
So the one, you know, and I want to get back to that, Joe, because like you've said before, your wife doesn't like all these kind of creepy, you know, horror stuff. Some of the stuff reminds me of, like, you think of like Hellraiser and you think of like Nightmare on Elm Street. Once again, I think a lot of them might have been, you know, inspired by this movie because this movie came out before then. But like this scene where on the roof, you know, or whatever, where the things on the roof or whatever, you know, ceiling, reminded me so much of Nightmare on Elm Street with John. Was it not Johnny Depp? It was the girl, right, in the beginning of the movie, going up on the ceiling, like going all around the ceiling and everything. And I was like, I wonder if Wes Craven was a really big fan of The Thing, you know, himself.
I think everybody who saw it was. And I think I mentioned, I was like a teenager when this came out and I saw it. And I can tell you the exact moment that I almost shit my pants watching this film. And that was when, after MacReady figures out how he's going to test everybody, and he gets everybody to get a little blood. And of course, that horrible part with the knife and the thumb, that wigs me out to no end. I still can't see that. And then he wipes it out on his jeans. Yeah. That is just so unsanitary. But the part where he gets the heated bit of copper wiring, and he's testing the first blood and it's okay. It just kind of sizzles. And then he tests the second one and the guy's like, oh, so he was human. That makes you a murderer, doesn't it? And you're like, oh, okay. Then he sticks to the other one. It's like, Wah! And it just wigs out. I nearly fracking lost it right there originally. It was just amazing.
Well, the tension leading up to that, where like you're saying, it's like one by one. It's like, you know darn well something's going to happen on one of them. And who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? And tying that little note in there when they killed Masseur's character, he's like, that makes you a murderer. That was, I mean, that leveled it just a little bit, but it was right after that. It was just like, and then this couple guys are sitting. Yeah. And then the couple guys are sitting there tied down next to the guy that like turned.
And then to make it even worse, the camera pans to the floor and you're seeing the blood that is just, you know, screamed. Yeah. And it starts running away and making noise. And you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that was really cool. But they would do a test and all of a sudden there's Kurt Russell's by himself. And then all of a sudden there's like five guys after the one gets windows and they blow that one up. Then there's like the three guys surrounding him, cop or the Donald Moffat's character. And it's just like funny how it's like, they're all like, you better not do nothing.
Yeah.
One of the scariest scenes in the movie is like when, I forget the guy's name, but the power goes out and he lights the candle and he's walking in and it goes, bing, 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 and it's like, what the fuck was that? Big shape moves by.
I think they did a couple really good like transition reveals of when they turn. It's like when they were given with the power for the guy having the heart attack, or seemed like he was having a heart attack. And next thing you know, it's like the charges just go straight through his body, and the guy's body turns into like sort of like teeth or something, and just sort of rips the guy's arms, it cuts him in half. Some very unique and surprising kills, and very graphic.
So one of the things that I really liked was, you know, you got to see sort of what the thing, I guess, was, you know, like you saw the little, I don't know what, worms or whatever, you know, like
tentacles and flowers and dogs, yeah, and
whatever, shit. All this shit. So you saw these little like worms like crawling on the ground, and obviously they had to shoot them on fire or whatever. But like you're wondering, I'm wondering, because I don't know if you guys ever seen The Faculty, you know, the movie that Robert Rodriguez did, and but they were like these little worm kind of things, you know, or whatever, that kind of came in and they would go through, I guess they would go through their ear, and it was very much the thing, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, it was the thing mixed with Puppet Master, or Puppet Masters, I guess, whatever the one with Donald Sutherland was, and everything, Robert Heinlein's one, and it also mixed with Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which this has a little bit of that in it too. So I think a lot of that was, and it's based on a book, right? Like the thing, book.
Yeah.
This is, you know, another, you know, idea of these aliens coming to Earth and basically stealing us, you know, or whatever. And but they fucked with the wrong crew, I guess, you know, that's the idea. And
it came from a book by a guy from the 50s, he wrote it was called Who Goes There.
Right.
Oh, so was that also set in Antarctica?
Yes.
Okay. So all of that was set like, cause that's the original movie, which was The Thing from Another Planet, I believe, or something like that. You know,
Another World,
from outer space or something.
Yeah. The Thing from Another World, I think is what it was called. And The Thing from Another World was, I guess, you know, John Carpenter loves, you know, like loves old movies, you know, or whatever, wanted to do his own, you know, wanted to do a remake, obviously picked a remake of something that wasn't as widely known, you know, or maybe it was back then. I don't know, but it wasn't as widely.
It's a classic.
I don't know. I never even knew about it till I'd seen or knew about The Thing.
John W. Campbell wrote the Who Goes There.
Nice.
And then I picked this up at some point. The Thing novelization by Alan Dean Foster.
Nice. And
have you read it yet? Or
I haven't. It's on my to read list.
Nice. So I'd be interested to know if it's really different, and or what differences there might be in it.
Shame on me. I really should read the original story. Who Goes There? I've never done that.
So I'm wondering The Thing novelization, because you know, sometimes the novelizations do take a turn or whatever. Sometimes they are based on the original scripts, you know, or something that never got, you know, published or whatever, never, you know, got changed along the way. So yeah, I definitely let us know if you ever finish reading it and you're on Hollywood
for our next episode. I'll do a book report on it.
Yeah, awesome.
Either that or a minimum, possibly when we do the recap at the end of the season.
Yes, perfect.
Yeah, that's cool.
That give you a little bit more time.
That gives you some more time to read it.
one thing I did want to bring up is that, you know, it is kind of a product of its time. And I have seen some people, I guess more modern people, kind of criticize the film because they said, oh, well, there was no women in there. There are no female roles in the film. But, you know, we're talking about a period in history where, you know, a military science expedition to the North Pole or to the South Pole, whichever, is, you know, the odds that they're going to have a female scientist there were pretty slim. And it's just a product of the time.
In The Thing, like prequel, wasn't there women?
So they end up doing that, right? They put a female American anthropologist there to sort of, you know, make it more modern. you know, I don't know.
The,
I mean,
yeah, that woman, she was the lead, I believe, in the
she was.
Yeah.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, okay. I mean, it did.
You guys saw it, right? You saw the, you said you saw it. Does it end, you know, and you can spoil this shit. I don't care because, you know, if people haven't seen it, whatever, but, you know, I don't care. At the end of the movie, does it set up for the John Carpenter one? Like, is there a dog running, yes. you know, running yeah. across and then somebody, you know, the Norwegian guy coming on the, in the airport. So so
if you watch the first 5 minutes of the movie and the last 5 minutes of the movie, that's a prequel. The rest of the is shit.
Okay. Yeah.
Very well put. Okay.
Now it makes me want to watch it because I want to trash it, you know. Now.
So it does like Rogue One and New Hope. It's like the last couple minutes of Rogue One leads right into New Hope and for Star Wars.
I actually Rogue One, to be honest, but you know, that's me.
It just comes off as extremely unnecessary because it doesn't really advance the overall narrative, in my opinion. I mean,
it's a transmedia thing. Leave it alone.
Not in a way that they could have done, you know, just by looking at what happened previously. No, it just wasn't good.
No wonder we're talking Star Wars and it's going to have there'll never be a unanimous perception. Which is part of the enjoyment of it.
Star Wars is a very political thing, you know.
The thing prequel, like if they would have just gone after the basics of the movie, like I would have liked to have watched them go find the UFO, watch them cut the thing out of the ice, you know. It was a Norwegian camp. There was no, you know, Americans there. Nobody knew about the thing. So, but the prequel brings in this lady who's assigned by the NAS or something to go investigate a crash UFO. It's like nothing adds up.
Oh, okay.
And then they have this whole thing where the UFO engines uncover it, and it's like, wait a minute, they blew it up with thermite. So it's like,
right?
I don't know. It's a alternate universe.
Yeah, I saw that it's on one of the major streaming services right now, so I might have to like check it out, at least to check out the ending of it to see how it blends right in.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm very cynical about these kind of things. To me, it was just an easy cash grab, and they just didn't care how, you know, well it fit in with the original film. Mm-hmm. They just didn't care.
Yeah,
CGI loses to the practical effects.
Yeah. Yeah, eight, 9 years later, I just sort of like, I don't even remember a whole lot about it, to be honest.
I can tell you that they ended up reshooting some of the thing footage with more modern CGI. I don't know whether you guys knew that or not, because in the original, sometimes if you're looking, you know, the part where they find the block of ice in the camp, you can, if you're looking really carefully, you can see some of the icicles kind of dangling around a little bit. Clearly they're not real. So they went back and covered that up, and they covered a few other things that, you know, through the passage of time, the original one just didn't look quite as good. And they didn't change everything, but they did go back and sort of cover up a few things with more modern CGI. You know, I understand that's acceptable.
But wasn't the bulk of this one, wasn't it shot like on like a handful of lots in LA? I think the bulk of this one. Yeah. So it's like they just turned the temperature down, and obviously LA is a lot different than Antarctica weather wise.
So I don't know. Some winters, I swear. I don't know.
80 to 100 degrees to like blizzard conditions is a bit different.
All right.
Well, Wilford Brimley was great in this, because when they go to the Norwegian camp, then they bring back the burn thing, and I always like the part where they pull up the thing. He kind of overacts the whole time. He's like,
right. This thing clearly stank, and thanks to Wilford, he sold that.
I'm wondering if this is what gave him diabetes. all right, so this is the first of John Carpenter's. Although it's
funny, if you pay attention, he's tapping the damn thing with the pencil eraser, and several times he puts it up against his face. I'm like, dude, don't do that.
Right. All right, so some trivia here. This is the first of John Carpenter's films, which he did not score himself. We've talked about that. The film's original choice of composer was Jerry Goldsmith, but he passed. And Ennio, how do you say his name, Alfred? You said his name really well.
Ennio Morricone.
Composed a very low-key Carpenter-like score filled with brooding, menacing brass chords. Now, I believe he was known for like a lot more of Sergio Leone's movies, right, or something, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
So yeah. He, like how the West was won, if I'm, you know, things like that. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which I mean, this obviously did not sound like a Western.
No.
I do like that Quentin Tarantino.
Godfather 3 too, I think.
I think this is one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies, or at least favorite scores, you know. So he did
use for
Hateful Eight. I love that because Hateful Eight had the feeling of The Thing, which you know, the idea of isolation and people being stuck together and not being able to leave, and you know, tension and stuff, which so I could definitely see this being like his homage, you know, his homage to a Western version of The Thing. You know,
I'm trying to picture Samuel L. Jackson in The Thing, and it's just not working for me.
What's funny with Kurt Russell with a beard in The Thing, and then he's got the beard in Hateful Eight, and then he's got the beard in Santa Claus Crying in Coles.
He likes his beard. Right? He likes his beard.
He walked
there.
Up to the Hateful Eight and went into the Santa Chronicles.
Now, if Jennifer Jason Leigh had been in The Thing, I'd have been very okay with that, although I can't imagine why she would have been there.
Honestly, she couldn't have been in The Thing, not the way that they really filmed it, but she could have been in The Thing sequel or whatever, you know?
Well, they could have, they was it Adrian Barbeau did the voice of the computer in the chess game or something like that? That was about the only,
dad
or whatever. I didn't know that.
I didn't
cheating
know that
bitch.
Either.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, see?
I love he poured.
What?
And then he poured the drink. He lost. He poured the drink into the computer.
Man, that made me
and
mad.
That's the thing. The one gripe I might have is some of the consistencies of some of the technology, because yeah, you got that game. That was a pretty cheesy, low tech, shitty kind of game. And then Wilford Brimley's in there with the lab, and he's like, "Oh, projection. What happens if the thing goes to the mainland?" And he's like, "Oh, it will take over the Earth in 27,000 hours." Get the fuck out of here! Where are you coming? What program is going to tell you that? Get out of here!
I mean, if you think about it, the low key chess game was probably something that they wouldn't have been able, you know, that they were just given on the base as just like. But
Chess Master 2000, man, that should be count for something.
But you know, it was early 80s, the computer, the home computer was still, you know, a magic box of wonder that you could pretty much explain anything with.
Yeah, I remember playing chess in that chess game too back in the day. I remember that one.
So that was a real chess game or whatever back then?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was available. God. I think I had it on the TRS-80 or something like that computer.
Jesus.
Way back, yeah. Paul might remember those type of computers.
I had
back in my drinking days, I was trying to find that whiskey that he was drinking. I was like, oh,
I know, right?
Try that one day.
My dad had the very first Apple computer. You know, I don't know what it was called or whatever, but it was the very first one, and we used it for so long, and then I needed I think it was fifth grade. I needed to be able to write stuff out because my handwriting was not legible back then, and I was not very good at writing, so they had me my teacher wanted me to write, so my dad donated that computer to her class, and so I don't think it's there anymore. I wonder where it went, but
those old TSRs, man, you didn't even have hard drives with that. You had to save your shit on a cassette tape,
not even a floppy disk.
Nope.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, see, I upgraded to floppy disk after that, and that's when I went to like the Commodore 64 and stuff like that. I think that might have been an upgrade and stuff like that. Moody, you're probably like, what's that, huh?
Commodore 64. I just never had it.
Okay.
I've heard of it. I've never had it. We had Atari, you know, and then obviously Nintendo. So we had those kind of things, but we didn't have like computer, you know, ones with the computer games, you know, like.
Now, did you have Atari 2600 or 5200? So was it like a little bit more advanced one, or was it like the original back to like almost like Pong and stuff like that?
We had the 2600. I think that was that the original?
We did too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we had Pong and we had like, off. There was like a Ghostbusters. My favorite game I had was a Ghostbusters game. And literally I rewatched somebody play it on like on TV to just remember seeing what it was like. It was the most boring fucking game. It's literally like drive, shoot a little
all
bit.
All those games are like, you always got the tank game, and you always figured out the cheat because you could shoot off the one side and appear in the other.
combat.
My other favorite game was Pitfall. Pitfall was fun.
And then the guy with the gun and the wagons, just it was always the same games.
So Pitfall, you had to jump on the alligator when his mouth was closed. I
always liked that one, just because it was fun to like swing on the vines or whatever.
We all know all these programs were savage barbarians until Oregon Trail. Thank you very much.
Exactly. That was one of the best ones to like kind of get it going some more.
How has no one made a movie called Oregon Trail based on that game is beyond me.
Well, I mean, I'm sure somebody has tried to pitch one, and maybe they died of dysentery. Who knows?
Uwe Boll can get his shitty movies based on games, he should be able to get an Oregon Trail.
Well, I guarantee you those things are like highly protected by somebody who owns the rights to that, you know, or whatever.
Well, I've seen little handhelds of Oregon Trail still like at Walmart in like the electronics section. They still sell them for like 10, 12 bucks or something like that.
I would love to get one.
Yeah.
My friend had an Oregon Trail one that said, "You died of dysentery," and I was so jealous. I wanted it.
All right.
So one other thing, you were saying trivia for the thing, and something else I was reading about is the weekend. It came out the same weekend as another great, in my mind, science fiction film that didn't do that great in the theaters, Blade Runner.
It came out
the same week.
A week later.
Yeah, E.T. was right around the same time. And I mean, obviously that cleared all the money.
I know,
but Blade Runner sort of overlooked. And because I looked at like that week and I'm like, well, it was top at the box office. And it was like that. And Poltergeist was in there. Those are a couple of the big ones. And I was just like, wow. I was like,
I was one of the very few screaming at the top of my lungs when they're trying to give everything to fucking E.T. And I'm like, dude, Blade Runner, the thing was, both of those movies were a million times better. Ugh,
well, you know, that's the problem with the companies and stuff. Fucking the Oscars and shit. Like most of the stuff is, like horror and sci-fi get like thrown out the window.
Yeah,
you know,
they're
not.
Respect.
Now, I think things are changing a little bit. And I think, I hate to say it, like you might, I don't know how you feel, Paul, about this, but I feel like Lord of the Rings has sort of changed that, you know, scope of things for sci-fi fantasy and everything. So all of a sudden people are getting, the Harry Potters and all these other movies.
Look at Parasite.
Yeah, Parasite.
Yeah, Parasite. There was also, I'm drawing a blank on another Shape of Water. That got some awards too, I believe. But Parasite was good. This next year, we're going to see it's a different type of horror film, but it's more of, I don't know if it's horror in the sense of graphic horror, but The Promising Young Woman came out this past year, and there's some horror elements to that because it's more mental horror.
You only have to look at some of the greatest films that have ever been created, like, you know, Stanley Kubrick, 2001, that got some Oscar nominations, but did The Shining, probably one of the greatest horror movies ever made? No.
Right.
You know? Might even say one of the greatest movies all of them.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, so
but Kubrick is one of those guys who pioneered it, and he pretty much is the guy who elevated science fiction to the point where you could consider it for Academy Awards. And horror didn't really have that for a while, even though he did his best with The Shining, and I thought The Shining deserved it, but that was just me.
Right.
I'm drawing a blank on what 1980, that'd be about the time like Raging Bull won or something like that, probably. I'll be somewhere in that area. I don't know the exact one, but Shining should have been. I don't even know what else came out then that could rival that.
I don't know. Well, that's the funny thing is I think The Shining did win some awards, didn't it?
I don't recall. Maybe cinematography, but I don't recall it getting in much of anything.
Oh, well, that's a bummer.
It might have not an award, but maybe a record of a movie inside of another movie now with the way they reused it.
When it came out, I remember because I had seen the book or I had read the book and it was one of my favorite books. And I think the consensus was most people who read the book, and a lot of people did, were disappointed that it didn't follow the book. And I remember seeing it and thinking, Jesus Christ, he took this book and made it a million times better. How did you do that? And I was one of the few people that I knew that loved the movie more than the book. And as time's gone on, I think most people prefer the film.
Well, you do know that we're going to be screwed with Stephen King stuff now, because any movie that, or any script that was made 35 years or less or whatever, are now in King's control. So King now owns the rights to everything, can do whatever the fuck he wants. That's why we got that It chapters 1 and 2 are exactly the way that Stephen King wants them. And the last one that wasn't King's way or whatever was Pet Sematary remake, and that was crap anyway. So yeah. I was disappointed by that. But I mean, I wasn't disappointed, because I heard so many bad things about it before I watched it that I was already like prepared to be like, ugh, you know. But I understand they tried something different.
First one wasn't very good.
I liked the first one with that Mary Lambert did. I actually really enjoyed that one. And the second one was crap. But you know, yeah, how do you make a sequel to Pet Sematary? You know, like it's, you know, but
Stephen King, I guess, will always have the original Shining. I mean, and what I was going to say a little bit ago is how they redid parts of it inside the movie Ready Player One. I loved how they did that too. So it's just, I mean, The Shining though is just in a different league when it comes to a lot of these movies.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about that when we discussed Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But as far as the thing goes, you know, to me, this was just a great, great classic American horror film from the 80s that really did not need to be redone for a modern audience. I think modern audiences were more than happy to have gone back and watch that one, and it would have been perfectly fine. It's just, you know, they want a cash cow and they're trying to get whatever they can. I'm surprised they haven't remade, you know, Mary Poppins or some of the other things just to remake it and put, you know, I don't know, whoever's the popular teenage twit these days.
No, Mary Poppins, they just had a return. That was all. They just had her. With this one, I think they did a sequel, they were going to do a sequel mini series or something, but then they ended up doing a video game that supposedly takes the story a little bit further. Cause I mean, there is different interpretations of the ending of the thing.
And I could see if somebody decided to do the thing and turn it into a series, like a 12 part series, and sort of broaden everything out, because I could see that, because now you're taking the story and you're elongating it and you're filling in a whole bunch of stuff and you're expanding it. You're adding something to the narrative, you know?
Right.
You're not just trying to capitalize off of its name and that's it.
Well, and
I was just going to say that would work. I would, and that's sort of what things are going toward these days. Is it's not about movies, it's about mini series on these, you know, like even to go back to A Hateful Eight was broken up into like a longer thing and turned into like a mini series, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So I think that's what people are liking, because now with long form television on streaming devices, we can do that, you know.
Right. They call them, you know, bingeable bits, because you watch the whole season whenever the hell you want.
Right.
But I think that they could do something with this if they really wanted to in a series format. Because when I was watching it, under the context of 2020, 2021, you have the paranoia of like when you're going near somebody, do they have COVID and stuff like that. And then in the 80s, there was like the whole thing about AIDS and stuff like that. So it's like the paranoia of not knowing if somebody has something or somebody's possessed with something, in this case of the thing. Watching the thing, it's like, okay, one person's looking at the other person, they don't know if they're good or bad, or if they have issues, it's going to end up killing you and stuff like that. So I think that could work in maybe a series or something like that in today's time.
Sure.
And you like can social distancing and prepare your own meals and, you know.
Yeah. You know. And you can actually address the one thing that a lot of people didn't really care for, which is the ending. What happens? What happens to these guys? You could actually write something that sort of maybe talks about it or explains it or expands it. Maybe they last, you know, a couple of days, maybe a week, maybe only a couple hours. Maybe they meet the thing again. Maybe one of them becomes a thing, you know, maybe one of them becomes a thing and actually survives. And now there's a thing somewhere else. I mean, you can go in so many different directions with that. It's really open-ended. Yeah. And
Dark Horse Comics did a follow-on. Dark Horse Comics did like a sequel.
Oh, cool.
In the late 80s, early 90s. I'm sure you can find the graphic novel of it on Amazon.
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe they brought that to civilization. Then it's like then you got like an infestation in the world. So I mean,
I'm trying to remember it, but I got to dig it out to get my comic. So that's my part two of my assignment.
Yeah, I remember that they did it, but I never read it. I never saw it. I never even saw it sold, so I never got my hands on it. So
but I think you picked a good one.
You got two great characters, and both going, what do we do? And John, he says, I've got any surprises for each other. I don't think we're in any shape to do anything about right. it.
they just had their drink, and they had, what was it, the J&B whiskey yeah. or vodka or whatever? I don't even know if that's a real brand.
Oh, yeah.
Something it is. Made up. Is it? Well, they had good product placement for that time period.
And what I love is, you know, he's the whole time, you know, MacReady's been drinking it with ice cubes, and now he's out there. He's like, hey, just grab some ice or snow right next to you and throw it in there, because that's right there now.
But I think you picked a good one to start the season.
I do. You know, and I think perfect too, because it's sort of winterish, you know, kind of the story, you know, like it's kind of fits January. So there you go. I'll say it's a movie I'm probably going to watch more and more, you know. I just said that the second time I'm watching it got me that way. So I think, you know, and the more we talked about it, the more I go, you know, maybe I should give it like 10 more chances. You know what I mean? Like keep watching. I think the more I watch it, the more
the movie
I'll probably
wouldn't work if it was on a beach house in Miami Beach. It just wouldn't work.
You know,
I think the point that I was saying at the beginning, and wrapping up to this thought here, is seeing that it is in a very claustrophobic space is a constraint, but it also shows what can be done with the camera and what can be done in the right mind to give you a whole scope of what the world is, but yet keep it very confined.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly, you know, it's claustrophobic. It makes you feel paranoid. You don't know what's going to happen next.
And
you know,
do some surprising stuff. How many of you guys, when the first time you saw this film, remember when they go down into the ice tunnel and they're trying to figure out when the thing stole stuff, and you see that wooden floor, and then the thing comes rushing up, and you see the floorboards all divide and go.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that. I hadn't seen that before. That was fracking cool. And the fact that you're in this tiny little tunnel just makes it even more horrific. You know.
Definitely. Yeah,
it's like you ain't getting out anywhere, but yet, how are you going to make it through that? And and visually, it was quite well done.
Awesome.
Well, I'm excited for when we do our recap thing, because I'm probably going to watch it at least one more time before then. And then we can kind of talk about it again a little bit. An idea that I had was also, and we'll see what happens, but on the recap episode, we can invite the guests who were on, you know, before to come back on. So Paul, if, you know, I don't know if you'll be back for another one or not beforehand, but if not, we can have you back for the last episode, if you want to come on and talk about, you know, all the other stuff, and, you know, especially the ones that you obviously were a part of.
Well, I appreciate being on here, and I love the thing. It's one of my favorite films. And last creepy moment is the one guy they catch just before he finishes changing over, and, you know, they chase him down in the snow, and then they're like, oh, don't touch him, don't touch him. And they're about to burn him. And he turns around and he looks at him, and he's like,
oh. Yeah.
It's like, Jesus Christ, burn that sucker.
All right. Okay, so this is the end of our show. I want to thank everybody, especially you, Paul, for coming on for your first time here, and Joe for being our special guest. So I'm going to go around, and I'll start with Alfred. Alfred, what do you got to plug?
On my Performance Enhancing Films podcast, we interviewed Jonathan recently, and then had our 25th episode. So I'd like to send a formal invitation to Paul and Joe to be on and basically tell them movies that influence your career and your performance and stuff. So we got that.
Can we talk about what we did? Can we say what we did, or do you want to keep that as a
sticker? We have discussed
Ed Wood. Ed Wood. Yeah. Yay. And we had a fun time with that one. The movie Ed Wood, not Ed Wood himself. Yeah. Though there was a lot of talk about Ed Wood himself too in that discussion.
And I've also got a Star Trek one called Warp Core Ejects that we're about to record our second episode next Monday.
Outstanding.
Aww, that's great. And
basically, the theme with that is we've got myself, I grew up with Star Trek from the 70s. One of my other friends grew up with it in the 90s. And one of our other friends from the theater, she just started watching it during the pandemic. So we got three generations of people in their views on Star Trek.
Oh, that's great.
All right. How about you, Joe? What do you got going on?
I'm working on a few personal ideas for myself. And other than that, I'm talking with you on some different projects and different things, and hopefully get those things rolling in 2021 and make it happen.
Yeah, we definitely got a lot of, especially in March, we got a lot of shit going on in March. Alfred, I'll be back in March to be, and so maybe we can hook up then and do something, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
We were supposed to do something this, you know, whatever. We're supposed to do this episode in Virginia. We're planning it, but I'm very glad we didn't. There was a lot going on, you know, we all had a lot going on at that particular moment. And so hopefully March will be a little bit better of a time. And how about you, Paul?
Well, in addition to my usual turn as one of the co-hosts for Indie Film Cafe, we have Forgotten Horror Classics is currently on hiatus. I have swapped that out for another podcast currently being run, which is called Sexploitation Sleazecast, which is kind of taking a look at some of the sketchier films that are out there. And I'm doing that with Rebecca Reinhart. And we'll probably swap that back again. And then I'm going to be doing a vidcast called Blue Cheese, which is going to be stinky bad movies that are on Blu-ray. Because I'm
nice.
What the heck? Because, you know, as Jonathan knows, I was very, very systematic about the only things I wanted to have on Blu-ray were all my really good high-end Criterion level kinds of stuff and all the crap and silly stuff I was going to keep on DVD. Well, as time's gone on, you can get a Blu-ray for just as cheap. So I figured you may as well start collecting some of the crappier ones. And now I've got a nice little collection going. So why not start talking about stinky movies on Blu-ray? So this was
That's
good
awesome.
Chance.
Love the title, Stinky. What do you say, Stinky Blue Cheese?
Nice. Stinky nice. Blue Cheese. That's awesome. So we've got a lot going on in Indie Film Cafe. We've also got a Patreon. So everybody, please. Please, you know, donate $1 at least. For just $1, you'll get Patreon only content, podcasts and vidcasts and other stuff that we'll be doing. But for bigger tiers like $3, $5, $10, you can get other, you know, other stuff like behind the scenes, and you'll get early access to things like this and stuff like that. So,
and you definitely want to check out our Star Wars holiday special, because that was pretty yeah. awesome. And I got the chance to torment Moody with that one. That was a lot of fun.
We're trying to get Joe, but Joe did not want to come for that one. You know, he was like, nah, never mind.
I am one of the biggest Star Wars. I time wise, it didn't work out, but I'm one of the biggest Star Wars fans, but I know what that's all about. You know?
Have you seen it, Alfred?
When it came out, I haven't seen it since. So I got to watch it.
I don't know who wants to watch it. Jesus.
I think it's on YouTube. It was on YouTube or something.
It was on YouTube, and we found out it's on Riff Tracks.
I love tormenting people with it. It's so much fun.
Yeah, Riff Tracks did a version, so I want to listen to that at some point. I think it was our buddy Chris Roll who said, you know, are you listening to the Riff Tracks version? You know, and nope, Paul had the 2-hour long real version.
Right, I had the complete one, not because there's like 4 edits that are out there, and I had the complete one, which was
It was terrible. It was hard to watch.
Did you get the one? So you had the one that had the animated introduction of a famous character.
Yes. We can mention it. Boba Fett, man.
Right.
So when that happened,
probably the best part of the movie.
He didn't tell me that about this at all. Right. He just said that there's going to be some animation in it. So I was like, all right. So animation was the best part of the movie, honestly.
It was weird, but
it was weird, decent. But it worked for that thing. But there was like a. I looked over at Paul and I go, is that Boba Fett? Like, this was pre-Empire, right? Like, and yeah, it was the first, and it looked just like Boba Fett. Like, they pretty much took the outline of what, I guess George Lucas had Boba Fett in mind for a long time of what he would look like, and they just animated what he would look like, and I thought that was, I thought that was amazing. You know, that was the best part of the whole movie, you know.
Moody loved it. He said he's going to start celebrating Wookiee Life Day every year from here on out.
I'm going to just try to listen to B. Arthur sing every day of my life, you know.
You want to listen to 20 minutes of Wookiees going,
with no subtitles whatsoever. So we have no idea what they're saying, which I'm like, all right, this is
just... Oh, scratchy and lumpy and itchy and oh my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, God. Awesome. So thank you guys. This has been awesome. This is a great, I think, introduction back to the show again. Please. For another amazing season. So like every season we do something different. It seems first season we do like 30 episodes. We're going to do 10 episodes. I think that's fair for everybody, and once a month. And so next one is Alfred's, and then Joe's, and then mine again. So we're really excited to hear what Alfred picks. You don't have it figured out yet, do you?
I do.
Oh, do you want to tell us? You can tell us now.
James Cameron, Aliens.
Oh my goodness. All right. That is going to be wonderful. I can't wait.
One express elevator to hell, man.
I just saw the first one in the theaters last weekend again. They put it out at the theaters. I saw the first one. I'm hoping they put the second one there. Nice. I'd love to see that on the big screen.
Oh my God. I can't even go to a theater. All the theaters are shut down. You know, I'm like.
Well, I'm getting ready to see Karate Kid on the big screen.
Oh, nice.
That's coming.
So freaking jealous. Oh, I would have loved. I was two when that movie came out. So, I was just born when The Thing came out. You know, I was.
They should be Karate Aliens. How awesome would that be?
Karate thing, Karate Aliens. You know,
Karate Aliens.
Awesome. I would watch that. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. Please stick around so I can talk to you guys before. But thank you guys. And thank you everybody for listening. Hope you guys enjoy the show. Tune in next month when we're going to be talking about James Cameron's Aliens. So, bye everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You're listening to the Hollywood Boulevard Podcast.